Welcome to the premiere episode of the Horses Equine Innovators podcast, sponsored by Zoetis Animal Health. I am your host, Michelle Anderson, Digital Managing Editor of The Horse. Every day, researchers at universities and other institutions around the world are investigating new ways to care for and understand our horses. In this podcast series, we'll be talking to those innovators to learn more about their work. Our guest for this first episode in the series is Dr. Martin Nielsen, an equine parasitologist and associate professor at the University of Kentucky's Maxwell H. Gluck Equine Research Center. He also co-authored the American Association of Equine Practitioners Parasite Control Guidelines. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us, Dr. Nielsen, and thanks for being our guinea pig on our first episode.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with your background. I know that you started your career as a practicing veterinarian in Denmark. How did you end up transitioning from being a practicing vet to research? And I think the big question is, what got you interested in worms?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's actually one that I often get asked. What on earth? What happened? I mean, how could this? Going to veterinary school in Denmark, that's kind of where I even developed the sort of interest in research. I didn't really know anything about it prior to going to vet school. I hadn't ever thought about, I'm not even sure I knew what a PhD was. I just wanted to be a veterinarian. But going through school, I just developed an interest in the equine, or not the equine, the parasitology research group at that university at the time was extremely active, had a lot of funding, had a lot of people working. And at one point, I think they had like 30 PhD students engaged in parasitology projects. None of them were equine, but lots and lots of projects and lots of funding, so lots of opportunities to, you know, join the team and be a student worker. And I was one of many, many students that earned a little extra on the side and helped out with various parasitology projects. And so I think, you know, I got my hands up there. And then in the Danish veterinary curriculum, you actually do a research project. It's a mandatory thing as part of the education that every veterinarian will actually have done their own project. They will have written up a report and defended it, sort of a mini master's. And so, of course, I chose to do it in parasitology. So my interest was there already. Late 1990s, I was interested, even as a vet student. Right around that time, Denmark was changing their legislation to make all dewormers available on a prescription-only basis, so only through veterinarians. And you know, horse owners or animal owners in general would only be able to get their dewormers through their veterinarians. And the veterinarians would have to do some kind of diagnostic work to, in order to be able to justify the prescription. So, you know, that just led to a lot of questions. I mean, I was just wondering, how is this going to pan out? Is it going to be such a dramatic change to from an over-the-counter availability, just like we have here in America, to this system? Is it even going to work? What are the needs? I mean, are we even ready? Do we have the everything we need to in order for that to work out, in specifically perhaps to diagnose the parasite so the prescription can be made? So that happened in 1999. And like I mentioned before, there was a lot of research going on in parasitology at the university. Nobody was working on horses. So I thought, man, you know, I might be that guy. I did go into practice that you mentioned. I thought, you know, I started out wanting to be a veterinarian, you know, driving around my truck in an ambulatory practice. So I felt I had to do that and try that out and see how that worked for me. And in many ways, I loved it. I enjoyed this whole thing of showing up in the morning and not knowing what the day would look like, and driving around and getting into contact with a lot of people in a lot of different places and helping them with their animals. I loved that. What I didn't like, I realized, was this sort of generalist approach to things. You rarely had any time to get into the depth of any particular question or problem. You just sort of had to come up with something quickly and then move on to the next patient. And I just realized more and more that my temperament was to sometimes really dig deep and get all the evidence, all the information you could get about a particular problem, and then see what you could do to resolve it. And that's really the approach you take as a researcher. And that's what led me to go back into to graduate school after 3 years of practice. And long story short, although it's already a long story, I'm sorry, but I'm now here at a premier equine research institution where, you know, we have a department full of people all devoted to helping the horse.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a lot of what led you into this work was timing and your exposure in vet school. But what then led you to the US and to Gluck to work in your lab there?
Yeah, that's also a great question. I mean, yeah, your point is a very good one. The timing, it's kind of a random thing sometimes. But you know, you get into contact with it's a kind of what people you run into in your, you know, on your path. And I say this to all the young people that come through my lab now, you know, you might run into something that a certain topic, certain area of work that interests you, but it's very often dependent on the people. And we had a professor at the veterinary school in Denmark at the time who was particularly keen on encouraging young people into getting involved with parasitology. He wasn't doing that across the board with everyone, but when he sensed that here's somebody who might actually have a little bit of an interest, he would encourage, he would make suggestions of ways to get involved, things that you could do, projects you could be involved with, meetings you could go to, and basically just provide young people with that opportunity. And so that's what he did. I'm just mentioning that. I'm trying to do that same thing now, and I think a big fulfilling part of my work now is, yeah, we do all this research, but we're also engaging young people and providing them with that opportunity to be involved with research at some level and get a little bit of a, you know, peek into the wheelhouse and know, you know, how does it work when you're generating scientific information? How does that all work out? How I ended up in the US was also interesting because I came back to the University of Copenhagen before starting my PhD, wanting to do equine parasitology. Because I'm sure I had identified this gap, nobody was working on it. And so I was able to find two great supervisors, PhD supervisors, but none of them had a research program in equine parasitologists. One was a general parasitologist with some interest in equine, and then the other was a clinician, also with a great interest in equine parasitology, but none of them had an active research program. And so I needed to find somebody with more specific knowledge, because when you read the papers and you're trying to figure out what should my project be about, you only, you know, reading the published papers, you only get part of the story. You get all the things that worked out and that worked out, you know, good enough to be able to be published, but you don't really get a feeling for, you know, what thoughts might people have had, what approaches might they have tried that didn't work out. And all of that you need in order to be able to define what a project should be about. So I started reaching out to people that I could see I've been publishing about equine parasites, and that led me to the US. So in 2004, I reached out to Dr. Tom Ply at the Louisiana State University, who had been a leader in the area for a long time, and basically asked if I could come just to seek some inspiration, have some conversations with him. And he said, sure, Martin, but why don't you make and he put it as a small circular drive, visiting three other guys in the southeast of the United States. And I said, well, that sounds, yeah, that's probably like a few hours of driving, and not, you know, being naive, never having been to the US before, I didn't really realize what that would entail. But yeah. He then introduced me to three people, Dr. Gene Alliance here at the University of Kentucky, Dr. Craig Reinemeyer at the East Tennessee Clinical Research, and Dr. Ray Kaplan at University of Georgia. And so I ended up visiting all four in the matter of 11 days, spent a lot of time on the road, was extremely critical to my career that I got to meet these people, and they were all extremely welcoming, set the time aside, talked to me, make suggestions, and also basically just sort of offering their thoughts on where I should be going. And so they all became part of my network. And ultimately, they're the reason why I'm here today. I did not go to Kentucky at the time, but already then I was aware of the extremely unique resources that are available here. I ended up hooking up with Dr. Kaplan at Georgia. He had some thoughts on, you know, some molecular techniques we could develop for diagnosing some parasites. And I ended up spending a significant part of my PhD with him. I owe him a lot. He's been such a support, such a great mentor for me, both during the time as a PhD student and still actually now to this day. And so that's where my U.S. connection was established. And then I went back, I graduated from the University of Copenhagen PhD. I got my first faculty position there, working in the clinical department. But then I was, you know, fortunate to get a grant that allowed me to go on a sabbatical. I thought, all right, I've been to Georgia, where should I go next? And I thought, well, Kentucky. You know, they had these resources, this wealth of knowledge. Dr. Gene Lyons was a living legend in parasitology. So I went here on a sabbatical back in 2008-2009. And that's where the department chair, the director of the Gluck Center at the time, Mats Troelsen, sort of pulled me aside and said, hey, Martin, what are your career plans? And I'm like, well, I have a faculty position. I don't know where you want to go. And he's like, could you see yourself working in the U.S.? And I said, I think you need to ask your wife. And so yeah. He and actually Dr. Ed Squires, who was at the Gluck at the time as well, and basically invited us all out one night. And I told my wife, you know, they're going to ask us about this. And she's like, okay, all right. And we sat there at this dinner at this restaurant. And I remember we were chatting and they didn't sort of, they didn't really bring it up. And I was like, oh, well, maybe I misunderstood. I mean, we like starters, nothing happened. The main entrees, nothing happened. Dessert, they still didn't talk about it. And we were like, okay, they asked for the check. And I thought, okay, well, maybe it was my Danish English. Maybe I just misunderstood the whole situation. And we got up, you know, Ed Squires signed the bill and the tip and everything, and we stood up on the way out. And then he just leaned over to my wife and said, hey, oh, by the way, could you see yourself living in the U.S.? And she said, sure. And he said, all right. And then they set everything in motion to try and advertise a position. You know, those have to be advertised and made open to others to apply. That's where the financial crisis hit everywhere, including here. So this university went into a hiring freeze and weren't allowed, you know, the department wasn't allowed to open any new positions. And so Dr. Johnson called me up and said, Martin, I'm sorry, we're in this situation right now. We just can't do anything. And I thought, oh, well, yeah, you know, it's one of those, you know, nice, encouraging conversations that just didn't pan out for reasons that's nobody's fault. And, you know, so over the course of the next couple of years, he sort of checked in with me. He's from Sweden. So he would sometimes be heading home to visit family, and he would always swing by Copenhagen, and we would just sit down and chat. And I was like, oh, well, I mean, it doesn't hurt. Then a faculty member here at the Gluck Center actually passed away. Very sad, very unexpected. But that, you know, all of a sudden there was this unfilled position, and Dr. Troelsen was able to convince the dean at the time that, you know, this, it would be useful to convert that into a parasitology position, because Dr. Lyons, we had established this program and the department wanted to make sure that they could continue it, you know, going forward, should he all of a sudden decide to retire or just pass away, you know, or whatever. And the dean allowed it. So then finally the position was available, was advertised, and I applied, and I've been here almost 9 years now.
And so, you know, you named some big name in parasitology that those of us who write and work in the horse health space are really familiar with. But I think it brings up this interesting thing that we're seeing in research is a generational shift.
Yes.
Where we had, yeah, so we had all these greats in, that were boomers, and they're retiring out or aging out of the work. And then you, like me, are in the Gen X, the sandwich generation, and there's a lot fewer of us. And then we're followed by this big millennial generation that I think outnumbers the boomers at this point. So do you find in research that that you're in a space where there aren't quite as many people entering your field of research?
Interesting question. I kind of think that in my area of pure cytology, and this is generally speaking, not just equine, I think we went through sort of a dry period, funding-wise, up through the 80s, 90s, and perhaps even the early 2000s, where, you know, we had all these great dewormers and everything was under control, and there was just less incentive to invest a lot of funding into research. So I actually think that generation struggled a little bit. For me right now, I can tell you it is way different. There's a lot more need, and it's much more recognized now for research and certainly for my area, equine. And I also get a lot of interest from young people. So I'm not struggling when it comes to attracting or finding the next graduate students and engaging young people and engaging my undergrads and my veterinary students. I think we're on an upswing, and we have been for a while when it comes to just recognition of the need and also the availability of at least some sources of funds. We can discuss those more in detail if you're interested. But I want to sort of, you know, I think things are looking pretty positive. And the other point that you bring up, which I just like very briefly would like to touch upon, is this whole thing about the shift between generations. I think it's so important to make sure that the knowledge gets passed on. And there's so many ways to do it. I mean, one is obviously through training students that come out of your lab, and the people I mentioned before have all been part of that and done that and ensured that there's a legacy. But I also think me working with all of them, you know, has been so valuable for me in my career that I've been around, I've been able to have interaction with these great people with all the great knowledge, and specifically, particularly Dr. Lyons that I worked alongside with here for many years. That's so valuable and important. And those are all the things that aren't necessarily all written down. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
Yeah. So why is the work that you do and your colleagues do, why is it important for the horse owner, for people like me at home with our horses that every day aren't living in your world? You live in and breathe horseworms. But what does it mean for those of us on the ground?
I mean, it's important because all of you, and I mean really all, everywhere in the world, everybody who has horses deals with parasite control. It's just part of the handling and the managing of your horse. You all have to make some decisions regarding what to do, when to do, with what, and how. And those are the questions I get all the time. And so my mission is to provide those answers. We all deal with parasites, whether we want it or not. There is not a horse out there that doesn't have any parasites. They all have them. And so there's always going to be all these questions, and they will never go away. And so, yes, it's very important. It's important because, you know, we're sort of finding ourselves more and more with our back up against the walls because of all the drug resistance. We're running out of treatment options. So what are we going to do and how? And should we ever get a new type of dewormer on the market? I don't see that coming anytime soon, but hopefully it will happen. What are we going to do different? Can we do it a little bit, you know, can we be smarter in how do we make use of these products? Can we learn from the past? I think those are important questions, and those apply to everybody. It doesn't matter whether you have like the fanciest, most expensive horse, like top performing athlete or breeding horse in the world, or just your backyard pony. You know, the parasites don't care. They're not snobs. They just infect the horses. So.
Something that's been really great about your work is that you can speak to the researchers, but you're also really good at speaking to the horse owner and sharing information with horse owners. And recently you won the Winnie Award from the Equus Film Festival for your educational videos targeting the horse owners about debunking deworming myths. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, I think it's an obligation as a research scientist, and certainly someone working at a linguistic university, to disseminate knowledge to what I call the end user. You know, it's veterinarians, horse owners, managers, people that deal with parasite control on a practical level. And it's an obligation that we have to basically find effective ways of communicating this and, you know, bringing the message across. And I like to just try out different platforms, different media, if you will, social media. We're having these discussions here in the department. I mean, should we increase our presence on social media? And my opinion is a big yes. I think we have to. But there are so many different ways of doing it. So what I did with that video series was just like, I wanted to prove a point. I wanted to basically demonstrate with your own smartphone, and iMovie, you can make, you know, videos without spending oceans of time, and they could be effective. And I wanted to make them short, 45 seconds or less, so they could go on Twitter as well as Facebook, as well as on my YouTube channel, just to try a different format where you basically have a single message. We know that people's attention span on social media might not be more than a few seconds anyway. So just, you know, cut to the chase, bring the message across, and then a brief explanation why. So that's what I wanted to do. And I've, you know, having worked in this field since veterinary school, I've come across so many misconceptions and myths and, you know, traditions that are not based in anything. That I would like to try and address and make people aware. So that's how that idea of debunking some of those misconceptions or myths. And that series ran in the fall of last year, so 2019. The videos are all still available on the Gluck Equine Research Center Facebook page. You can look that up and find the videos between October and December of last year. With comments and questions. You can also find them on my YouTube channel, Martin K. Nielsen, Equine Parasitology. All the videos are there as well, as well as on my Twitter feed, at Martin K. Nielsen. So just really trying to spread the message in a manner that is meaningful and useful to people. I learned about this film festival, and the director of the film festival, Lisa Dearson, encouraged me to enter my film into the festival, and she told me there was an educational category, and I thought, why not? And I won, so that was quite something. I think I'm going to do another video series again, if I can find the time. I'd like to make them a little longer this time, try a slightly different format, a little more educational. I was inspired by some videos my daughter was watching. She was preparing for a history exam that she was taking in high school. And there was this guy who was doing like a brief overview of, you know, his different historical periods in world history. And I thought I could do the same with you know, parasites, and here's how to approach putting together a parasite control program for foals, for yearlings, for young horses, for broodmares, et cetera, et cetera. So if I can find the time, I will try to do that.
So for our audience, I think a lot of us, when we think of research and researchers, we think lab coats and microscopes. So that's part of what you do, but you also have a research herd there at UK. Can you describe to us what that herd is like and what they're used for?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, when I talked about the unique resources that I noticed already as a grad student here at the University of Kentucky, I particularly meant those two researchers. They are really something else. I mean, Dark Alliance, who was here, passed away 2 years ago, had maintained these for decades. There were two herds. They were both established in the 1970s by him and his colleague, Dr. Harold Drudge. And they went to, I don't know who had the idea, but they decided to basically just not like keep a herd of horses without deworming. And I think kind of just see what happens. And so they, that herd is, I inherited that herd, and that's major resource for me now as a source of research samples and materials. They haven't been dewormed. The horses, now several generations of horses, have not been dewormed for 41 years this year. And so they have a lot of parasites, and actually in quite high numbers. The horses are remarkably healthy. We use these for a bunch of different things. And some of my videos in that series in the fall actually talk about that. So how I get seasonal data, data on seasonal fluctuations for different parasites. We've also developed several diagnostic techniques, new diagnostic tests for parasites. And for those kinds of tests, you need to validate them. And in order to be able to validate a diagnostic test, you need samples from animals where you know that they're infected with a particular parasite. So you can make sure that the test is actually detecting it. That herd of horses is a fantastic resource for validating purposes and a lot of other things. The fact that they haven't been dewormed for 41 years means that the parasites are naive to ivermectin, to moxidectin, to drugs that the most used drugs, the most used dewormers in equine parasite control. And these parasites have never seen those. So they are not resistant. We can look at what the genes that may be to compare resistant parasites to parasites from these horses. And we can start mapping out, you know, what are the genes that are involved? There are so many different genetic mechanisms, and we are still struggling to understand exactly how drug resistance works on a genetic level in horse parasites or in parasites in general. The other herd is a herd of miniature horses that was established in 1974. And Dr. Lyons did a series of studies with these where he basically just dewormed them with, you know, not anything excessively, but with commercially available dewormers following sort of the norms of the time. He typically would treat them every 2 months year round, which is not what we recommend anymore, but that was recommended back in the 70s and 80s. And he just documented how quickly resistance develops. He first used one class of dewormer, the benzimidazoles. That's where you have fenbendazole and oxybenzole, so Panicure, Anthocyte, those kinds of products, and got resistance within 8 years. Then he shifted over to Pimentel products. That's your Strongit type dewormer. Same 6 times a year protocol, got resistance within 6 years, and now he showed that they had resistance to both. So these parasites are double drug resistance, which is actually the norm all over the world. So to have small strong drop parasites that are resistant to 2 out of 3 drug classes, and leaving only ivermectin and moxidectin as the last resort. And so we have a simulation, I call it a mini, pun intended, simulation of the real life scenarios that most people are struggling with and facing around the world. And that allows us to evaluate various deworming programs, regimens, in the face of resistance to kind of see what, when you already have resistance, how can you go about deworming wisely? And so it's just tremendous resources that you'll find nowhere else in the world. And I try to raise funding to support them periodically because I think they're worth maintaining for the future. And I think it's in everyone's interest that we keep these horses and make them available for the kind of work that we do. And I also make sure to share resources, samples, et cetera, with collaborators. Again, because we're kind of the only ones that have this, I get a lot of interest from researchers at other institutions, both here in the US, but also internationally, for samples and materials, et cetera, et cetera.
So besides the actual living, breathing horses in your herds, what tools do you have that technology allows you, or what technology allows you to also do your research?
What technology allows me to do my research? I mean, I think part of my research is actually to develop new technology. And so we, on the diagnostic side, we have developed a few diagnostic tests and we're helping colleagues develop and validate additional tests. So blood tests looking for blood worms in small strigels. These small strigels have this cystic stage where the larvae just sit in the mucosal wall and no egg count will ever detect them. And so finding a method that can actually detect the presence of these and approximately how many, that's a collaboration with folks over in the United Kingdom. And then we have this automated egg counting system that we have developed here. It's basically trying to see if we could get a machine to do the counting for us instead of us having to do it by the microscope with our little clicker. And then the concept is to use image-based analysis. So we have a system that takes a picture of a sample where the eggs are filtered and then stained, and then it's an image analysis algorithm that recognizes the eggs based on shape and size and delivers an egg count in 2.5 minutes. And we've developed that and validated that. It's very precise, much more precise than any manual count or counting method. And so those are technologies that we are part of developing, if not that we have developed ourselves. I think if you ask about emerging research technology in sort of in the broader picture, you know, one thing that's happening right now in this podcast series, you will be hearing about this from a lot of people, is the whole omics concept. So any word that ends with the word omics, that's just that's a description of a method that generates a lot of information. So for example, genomics. So all the genetic sequencing material from the entire genome. That's something we can do now from the parasites. We can do it for the horse, we can compare the two. And because it's become affordable, it used to be extremely expensive and price is going down every year, and the sequencing technologies are becoming better and better, so the quality of the data that you get is going to get better and better. You can do transcriptomics, so that's the genes that are expressed. So DNA is translated into RNA are the genes that are then active or upregulated. So not only can you ask what are the genes, you can also ask which genes are active in response to fill in the blank. And so again, we can do that in response to dewormers. You expose parasites to a certain dewormer. Are there any genes that are upregulated? Are there some genes that are downregulated? I had a PhD student just defending her dissertation this fall and doing exactly that with the aspirate parasites and horses. So, you know, all of a sudden we can start digging into these things that we weren't able to before. There's proteomics. So that's looking at what proteins are the parasites making. And there's metabolomics. So there's anything and everything omics. That's a big area right now, and it will continue to be going forward.
So when you talk about equine internal parasites, you talk about parasite control. And if horse owners are talking, we tend to say deworming, our deworming program. Why do you think it's important to shift that language from deworming program to parasite control program?
Well, I mean, because parasite control is more than deworming. And I think we want people to think about that and be aware that it matters how you manage your pastures, what quality the pastures are, the stocking density, and then if you want to do something sophisticated, you can do mixed or alternate grazing with sheep, cattle. That I see people doing in some areas of the world, not so much here in the States, but I see that a lot in Ireland, for example, and some in New Zealand. And so there are so many other things you can do that are helping control the parasites. Deworming also means getting rid of the worms, if you really think about it. And we have to realize that we're never, ever going to get rid of the worms, but we can keep the parasites under control so that we minimize or avoid that risk of parasitic disease. So that's the whole goal here. And I think we have to remind ourselves and each other that that's the goal, is to control the parasites, not eradicate them. I think we can say that we can actually try eradicating the parasites. I think that the chemical warfare we've been leading against them was probably with that in mind. And then I think, it's safe to say that we didn't really get rid of a single one of them, but we got a lot of assistance out of that exercise. So we know that that's not sustainable. So a little bit more of a holistic approach, where deworming is an incorporated part that will never go away, but we have to use our deworming products wisely.
So you mentioned that mini herd that you have at UK and the resistance and how quickly that developed with the internal parasites in those minis, which to me as a horse owner is kind of terrifying. But you said that those minis were dewormed on that traditional program that was recommended in the 70s and 80s. And I find that horse owners are still following those same protocols that are now outdated. Why do you think horse owners have been so reluctant to change and adopt parasite control guidelines rather than a deworming program?
I think there's several reasons for that. I want to emphasize that I actually do see change. I see change in what veterinarians are recommending now. I see that in a number of different places. This morning, I had an email come from the American Association of Equine Practitioners that I worked with, and they were like, there's this the survey that was recently published by the FDA, so the Food and Drug Administration of the United States, where they asked veterinarians, cattle and horse veterinarians, various questions about how they approach parasite control and what they recommend to their clients. And it was very clear that the equine vets are really recommending, all the right things, the things that we put in the guideline paper. So the message is coming across. And so I think we just have to realize the change of flow. We also have done a number of surveys targeting horse owners, and two of them, one was nationwide with the so-called NAMS, the National Animal Health Monitoring Systems. That's a program with the USDA. I was part of that with them, and the Equine Survey of 2015-16, we asked horse owners a lot of questions about how do we approach parasite control. And then we were able to compare those results with a similar survey also done by the same entity, NAMS, in 1998, so 20 years apart. And interestingly, we did see change. The change was primarily just not treating as often as back in 1998. So people they deworm less frequently per horse per year. That's interesting. And I think there's that recognition that, a lot, there's been way too many treatments, way too many deworming treatments administered. People have over dewormed and it hasn't been necessary. So that message has come across. But there is, certainly in that survey, a reluctance towards getting a whole lot of parasite egg counts done. And, when you think of the psychology there, you can actually understand why, because you look at two recommendations, One is deworm less. That saves you money right there. And so that's a no-brainer. And you realize that your horses are doing just as well with fewer deworming. So that's great. Everybody, you know, everybody's happy. Horses are happy and horse owners are saving money. Great. The other recommendation, adopting more parasite fecal egg counts, that comes with a cost. It costs you per sample for getting that analyzed, but it's also cost in terms of extra effort, getting the samples collected, getting them shipped or up to the clinic or whatever you're going to do. And you know, and the cost per sample is often more than it is for a dewormer. So there's reluctance there. And I think that's basically just because of the cost. And then there's, you know, there's some confusion. What do we do for those egg counts? What does it mean when you get an egg count? And what do you make of those counts? And I think that's where I come into the picture, really trying to educate and give talks, seminars, doing podcasts like this, really just trying to provide as much guidance as possible in terms of what to do with these things and maybe reduce some of that confusion. I think I often hear from people, I participate in a couple of those Facebook groups where horse owners can ask veterinarians questions, and I chime in there as much as I find time for. And they often say, you know, you get as many opinions about deworming as you ask people. The more people you ask, the more different opinions you get. And I see that, I recognize that. And I'm trying to just do what I can to at least provide the guidance that I think is right. And sometimes I make jokes about it and say, well, that's fine, you get a lot of different opinions as long as you just do what I say. I recognize that it's hard. And then, you know, the last thing that also is certainly a factor that plays a role here is just, you know, we are, you know, traditions can be strong. You know, I used to always do things this way. And as human nature, you're just not necessarily very willing to start changing something that you have done for a long time. And so that's also a little bit of the psychology we're up against, where, you know, people have a certain way of doing things they're comfortable with. They're, regardless of how much fancy information I might be able to show them or provide them with, it's still an uphill battle to get them to change their approach. But I think it's happening. I just think we have to be patient and just sort of know that this is a slow process and it's a gradual process. And that just requires people like me and my colleague, we just need to keep going. So.
But didn't you say that those minis, that those, they had resistance within 6 years?
Yeah.
So the resistance happens quickly, but change in our management is happening slowly. Is that okay?
No. I'm not here to say that this is all great. But I think we just have to accept those are the conditions we're working under. Changing direction, changing habits is something that you just don't do overnight. That happened quite quickly. I think as a general concept, I think we can say that resistance in parasites is much slower to develop than drug resistance in bacteria. And there's many, many reasons why, but it is a slow grinding process. With the aspirate parasites, the large roundworms and voles, that took, you know, 20 years. In 20 years of heavy usage of ivermectin before that started popping up in the early 2000s. And now it's everywhere. And so it is something that takes years, sometimes even a couple of decades, rather than weeks or months, like you sometimes see with the bacteria. And then the other thing that's different between bacteria becoming drug resistant and then parasites is once it's there in the parasites, it never goes away. So resistance, once it's developed, it is here to stay and it will never ever revert back to the parasites will never ever their bird backs would become susceptible to that particular dewormer again. So once we've lost a dewormer, you know, in a specific parasite, it's never going to come back.
So what's the consequence of that, of not having a way to treat those in horses that do need treatment?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's sort of pretty obvious. That, you know, we would like to be able to have an effective couple of treatment options for that horse. And we might be in a situation where we don't. And I think that's the big fear, that we end up having nothing that works. Even though most of the time, horses are completely healthy, even with sizable parasite burdens. But then every now and then there's the single horse that isn't, right? And that's really what we're here for. That's A, to try and prevent that from ever happening, and B, if it's happening, that horse is sick from its parasites, then we want to be able to treat that horse and do it safely and effectively. And those are scenarios that we are, you know, sort of moving towards. We can look at the small ruminants, the sheep and the goats, and they're a little bit worse off than we are with the horses, because there are plenty of examples of total drug failures where, you know, you have a population of parasites infecting goats or sheep, and nothing works regardless of what you're throwing at them. At least we still have a somewhat effective option for each of the important parasites in the horse, but we're, you know, we don't have as many options anymore, and in many cases we might be down to just one option for some of these parasites.
So with that in mind and the work that you're doing, where do you think we're going to be in 10 years when it comes to parasite control?
I mean, I hope that that we will have a new dewormer for horses on the market. Like I said, there's really no bulletins right now. It's been like this ever since I started, now 15 years ago. But in 10 years, there is reason to at least be optimistic and hope that something new could be made available. If that happens, I hope that we as an equine industry, including veterinarians and the pharmaceutical industry, have learned from the history and not going to be committing the same mistakes again, which is, no, forget about testing, just go ahead and blast them. We now have something that works, everything's great. I mean, if we end up doing that again, that'll be a terrible mistake. And I'm going to be here to do everything I can to prevent that. But I know that there's also some marketing forces in here where, you know, if you're a company, you want to maximize the selling. So there's some different interests there. So I certainly hope that we can at least approach this differently than how it was done in the past. And then I think, you know, we'll have more exciting and convenient diagnostic tests that are, you know, easy to use and cheap and meaningful, that will allow us and inform us about the needs of any particular horse. And so those are things. I think in 10 years, we'll know much more about all of the genetics that I talked about earlier with the omics approach. And I think that will provide us with much better understanding of the genetics behind resistance. It might also lead to discovering new drug targets and better diagnostics. So there's a lot of potential there that I think we'll be tapping into a lot over the next 10 years.
Well, we touched earlier on the new generation of researchers coming up and your work mentoring graduate students in your lab. Do you have any specific advice for young people who might be listening to this podcast and who have an interest in this area and want to enter it? What would you tell them?
I want to emphasize that, yeah, I have graduate students, but I have even more undergraduate students. I mean, probably currently I have about 10 undergrads working in my lab or doing projects with me. And I emphasize that because, you know, that everybody, most people, you know, in higher education at least, have been an undergrad at one point. And the earlier you can get involved with something like this, or just getting some experience with being involved with research, whether that be equine parasitology or something else, the better. And that's that's what I always say when I have a, I had an undergrad in my office just prior to us, you know, starting this podcast, and they're always asking, you know, they're saying, I don't really know much of research, Dr. Nielsen, but I'd like to get a little bit of some experience. And I said, that's a perfectly fine motivation for coming here and working with me. I mean, I don't need people to tell me I've always dreamt to be a parasitologist like you, because that's going to be a lie. In most cases, at least. But, you know, this just this general curiosity about something that they don't know about, but they're willing to learn about it. That's perfect. And so you know, I encourage young people to get involved, and at many universities, there will be, if you're interested specifically in parasitology and you're at a university with a veterinary school, there will be parasitology people, labs with researchers and people who do diagnostic work, where you can come and get involved and reach out. And I think most professors are like me. You know, we know that there's going to be a generation after us, and the only way to make sure that's going to really happen is to encourage and engage as many young people as possible. I've even had high school students come and do projects with me for their science fairs. That's been just as much fun. So I'm not saying you have to, I'm just saying that could also be an option to be able to do or get involved with some projects as a high school student. So I think it's just a matter of reaching out, and most labs will be very welcoming, unless they have like certain restrictions that I don't have with horse parasites, but other animals might have parasites that are zoonotic, meaning that they can infect people, and then there's some biosafety issues that you have to also deal with in order to get to work with those. Not that it makes it impossible, but that just is another little obstacle. Me with the horse parasites, none of them infect people, so we're very safe here. So yeah, I just encourage if anyone has an interest, and I get lots of people just asking me questions, emailing me, or asking questions on some of those Facebook groups that I mentioned before. I mean, there's always an opportunity to reach out and just ask. I'll try to answer.
Yeah, so that is the human resource, you know, bringing people into research and getting the next generation excited about research. But research is also expensive. Can you mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about funding sources and how research like yours gets the financing it needs to go forward?
Yeah, I think there's actually four categories of funding. So we have the federal grants like USDA, NIH, etc., where you can apply. There's calls for different themes, and then if you think you have something that might fit, then you can submit a proposal and keep your fingers crossed. So I've been funded through the USDA. Currently, I am funded in a collaborative project where we actually have a bacterial dewormer that we're testing in horses, and that could be something for the future. Actually, we did a treatment trial in the fall in foals, and this stuff just knocked out the aspirate parasites, which is very exciting. Didn't really do anything against the Stargell, so we need to look at what we can do to maybe make that work as well, but at least we have great promise with the aspirate parasites, just as an example. So federal funding being one category. Then I get what I call industry funding or pharmaceutical funding. So some of these drug companies, dewormer companies, some often would have an interest in us doing various projects that are related to something with our product. Not necessarily just testing the efficacy of a product, we do that too, but it's with the sponsor of this podcast, Zoetis. I have a long history of evaluating both inflammatory and immunological reactions to parasite infection in horses and to deworming of those parasites. So if you have a horse with a lot of parasites, big burden of parasites, is there any risk of an adverse reaction if you deworm it with a very effective dewormer? And we've done that with a series of different types of dewormers. And that's been a very, very meaningful avenue of research for me. And we've been able to really look at how the parasites interact with the host immune system and vice versa. There's a whole lot of crosstalk going on there. That's kind of fascinating. So that's just an example of some of that research. So industry funding was the second category. And then private donations, so philanthropy, if you will. So I do get donations from, single donations from the average horse person that just feels like, okay, Martin, Dr. Nilsson is doing some interesting work. I'd like to support it. I've run a few crowdfunding campaigns, rallying support, and that's been quite useful. I get support from some of the horse farms around here, elsewhere in the world, that just sort of appreciate the work that we're doing and want to support us going forward. Some of that goes towards those unique researchers that I talked about before. I mean, they don't come for free, so I do have a budget about $100,000 a year that I need to find in order to keep them. And so that's philanthropy, private funding. And then the fourth category is business investing. And so that's interesting when I talked about that automated smartphone-based app system that does the egg counting automatically with image analysis. We have actually established a little spin-off company. And then through that, we've been seeking private investors that are investing in the business. But part of that is research dollars that allows my lab to do more validation and develop and try different things. So in this day and age, you gotta just basically go in all possible directions that might lead to some funding. And it's a lot about selling your idea and pitching it. You know, it's kind of a Shark Tank approach sometimes. You know, what are you gonna get out of investing in Martin Nilsson's program? But I think it's a challenge. I think it's also a fun one many times. A big part of my job is to be a fundraiser and nurture these relationships with entities that could have an interest in what I do. So
that makes me want to see you go on Shark Tank. I think that would be a...
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see how Mr. Wonderful responded to horse worms.
Right.
We're coming to the end of our hour, but before we go, I wanted to ask you what the one thing you hope horse owners take away from this conversation, if they're listening.
If they're still listening, I'm going to say first, thumbs up. That's amazing. Thank you so much for staying with us. No, I hope that horse owners, veterinarians, etc., lead with the knowledge that we're here. I am here, my lab, my people, we're here to serve you. That's really our mission here. And that's really all it is. We're trying to do everything we can to help and to guide and to provide with new technologies, new options, treatment-wise, diagnostic-wise, basically answer the questions that you all face with. So I hope that that's the impression I've left. That's at least what I'm trying to do.
Well, that is all the time that we have for our conversation, but I want to thank you, Dr. Nilsson, for joining us. Really interesting conversation this morning.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's an honor to be the first.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, thank you. Thank you. And thank you for being so helpful. I also want to thank our sponsor, Zoetis Animal Health, for helping make this podcast series possible. And to our audience, thank you for listening, and we hope you will subscribe and join us for the next episode of the Equine Innovators podcast. If you're interested in more horse health news, please go to thehorse.com. Thank you, and we'll talk to you next time.